You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to the USDA, in 2012, 49 million Americans, one in six people, struggled with food insecurity, and that includes working families. Tracy McMillan takes a close look at what life is like when you don't know where your next meal is coming from, and you aren't sure your food dollars will stretch to the end of the month. Her article, The New Face of Hunger in America, is in the August issue of National Geographic, part of an eight-month series called The Future of Food, How to Feed Our Growing Planet. It's available online at nationalgeographic.com/food. Tracy McMillan is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. She's also the author of The American Way of Eating, and I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hello.
Thanks so much for having me.
How does hunger in America today compare with hunger in America in 1964 when President Johnson was moved to create the war on poverty?
Right. So hunger today has shifted in a couple of ways. First, we're now defining it not by straight starvation, right? So in the 60s, we were measuring it by our people having stunted growth and problems like that. Now the discussion is much more, well, you know, the U.S. is a fairly wealthy country. What about are people actually able to feed themselves? Are they able to keep their cupboards full and get meals on the table? And when you shift the numbers like that, it changes pretty dramatically. So in the 60s, it was about 1 in 20 Americans were struggling with hunger, and now the numbers are 1 in 6.
Despite the fact that we had a war on poverty.
Right, the war on poverty. Well, it did quite a lot in terms of expanding the food stamp program. And without SNAP, you know, I think you'd see much higher rates of food insecurity.
SNAP, which is being cut back.
Yes.
Why is food insecurity the preferred term now rather than hunger?
I think people wanted to get more at the reality in homes, right? And particularly with welfare reform, where you saw folks going to work for very low wages and not having a ton of time to think about food and eating and all that. Poverty reporters Jason DeParles talked about this, would sort of see all this intensity around food, but it wouldn't be, you know, starvation like we grew up seeing pictures of in the developing world.
Did it grow when the unemployment rate went up after 2008?
Definitely. Food insecurity does go up with unemployment, but what we're seeing is that it really sticks around, and the general understanding is that the reason it sticks around is because wages, you know, really haven't gone up, you know, significantly since the 50s or 60s, I think.
So it is low wages. What about the cost of food?
Well, the cost of food has actually, so in recent years, it's been going up. Over long periods of time, though, different foods, right, are going up and some are going down. So the cost of fruits and vegetables has gone up about 24% since the 80s, but sugar-sweetened vegetables has gone down by 27%.
So that's why we're seeing obesity, and we'll get to that in a little
right.
bit. What about poor access to food? We hear about food deserts all over the country, including right here in New York City.
Right. So the food desert issue is a little more complicated than I think the early conversations around it would have suggested. Certainly, if you don't have a neighborhood close to your home or a supermarket in your neighborhood near your home, it's much harder to get healthy food. You also have to think about what's in that supermarket. And while there's fruits and vegetables, right, the bulk of what's in a supermarket is usually a lot of processed food, and that tends to create diet problems.
You went undercover as a farm worker a couple of years ago, and you lived on less than minimum wage. Was hunger an issue for you and the other farm workers?
Hunger was a very constant issue for the farm workers and for myself. I lost probably about 10 or 15 pounds while I was doing that reporting.
Well, maybe I should become a farm worker.
I did photograph better during that period. You know, when I was working in the fields in Greenfield in the Salinas Valley, I actually would go and take part in a sort of a food bank, food drop thing, right, where a Good Samaritan was collecting day-old food from a supermarket and coming and dropping it off, and the other farm workers and I would sort of collect and get that. And that was really important for me to keep fed.
And were the farm workers aware of the irony and that they were planting and picking this food and then not being able to eat it?
Yes. One of the things that was interesting for me in doing the reporting for The American Way of Eating was I had this idea that I would go out and the farm workers would all be toiling very hard and they just sort of wouldn't realize and they wouldn't know what they were entitled to. And when you get on the ground there, it's sort of, oh, they know they're getting screwed. It's just that they don't usually have a way to fix it.
What about when you were working at Walmart and at Applebee's, which you also wrote about in The American Way of Eating?
Yeah, by the time I got to Applebee's, I was pretty good at economizing. Part of my difficulty, I think, when I was doing the farm labor is that not only did I have very little money to work with, right, I was making about $2 an hour, I hadn't ever had to live on that little of money. And so by the time I got to Applebee's, I was very good at saying, okay, well, I guess get a free meal every time that I work. So I'm going to have the burger and fries because that will keep me full for my 14-hour shift. And then I'll just eat toast and chicken stew the rest of the time.
Interestingly, Applebee's was in Brooklyn, in one of the most expensive cities in the country. Mm-hmm. Salinas Valley, I imagine, is a lot less expensive.
It's much cheaper in the Salinas Valley. It's not dirt cheap, but I mean, certainly I could go and get a sandwich for about $3.
My guest is Tracy McMillan. Her article, The New Face of Hunger in America, is in the August issue of National Geographic. Your article focuses on three areas, Iowa, Houston, and the Bronx, and three photographers took pictures of what hunger looks like in these places. Why did you choose those areas in particular?
Right. So the editors at National Geographic and I decided that we wanted to look at the different landscapes of American society. So we wanted to do rural, suburban, and urban, right? So Iowa we went to for the rural picture. Houston we went to actually the suburbs right outside to Spring. And then for the Bronx, that was sort of the iconic urban environment for us.
The photographers, and of course it's National Geographic, have to have a lot of pictures. Mm-hmm. They took pictures of people dealing with food insecurity in those areas, and we have a link to their photo essays on our show page. What do the photographs reveal that you couldn't reveal just with words?
I think the thing that you get from the photographs from, you know, Amy Tunstein, Keetra Kahan, and Stephanie Sinclair, who just did beautiful work, is you really see what a broad picture there is of hunger in the U.S. So it's not just homeless men at a soup kitchen, and it's not just, you know, low-income unemployed African-Americans in an urban city center, right? So you're seeing overweight white people in rural areas. You're seeing new immigrants. You're seeing a lot of working families. And you can say that all you want out loud, but until you see those pictures, I think it's hard to understand.
But they're very different than the pictures we saw during the Depression by was it the WPA project?
WPA, Dorothy Lane, yeah. All those. I mean, I think the something that—
They were so compelling, they really moved people to want to change things. Are these pictures as compelling?
I think they're as compelling, but it's a more complex story, right, because there's more nuance to it. I think the thing about the Depression was that it was very clear from the photography that these were people on the very margins of what we thought of as American society. And what you're seeing in the photography for this piece in National Geographic is that hunger is part of mainstream American society now. And so I think there's ways in which that's incredibly powerful, but it also takes a little bit of shifting the way you're thinking about it.
You spoke with a woman named Christina Dreyer in Mitchell County, Iowa. What was her situation?
So Christina is a mother of three kids. Her husband, Jim, is a farmhand. And so he was making about $14 an hour applying pesticides on fields. Christina had finished high school, but didn't have a whole lot of training or wherewithal to go get much of a job in any way. It would have made, you know, about $8 an hour, which wouldn't have covered child care. So she took care of the kids at home. And, you know, they were really having a hard time getting by. They basically would sit down at the end of the month and go through 7 or 8 bills and decide which one would get paid and which one they could put off.
They receive SNAP benefits, food stamps.
Yeah.
Have the recent cuts to their program affected them?
So the initial cuts in November did affect them. They went from about $200, $210 a month to about $175. I do know, though, that their benefits tend to fluctuate each month or so it might have gone up since then.
Did you see many people struggling even with the full SNAP benefit?
Even the full SNAP benefit is usually not enough for folks to not have to worry about food. So for Christina, she really used SNAP benefits as the start of her month shopping, and she was very excited because she would go and she would actually buy produce for the kids. So she'd buy, you know, apples and grapes, and she said to me, you know, oh, this is great. We have apples and grapes, and they'll be gone this week, and we won't have any more until next month.
And what does she do to get the other food?
So the rest of the food's from the food pantry in town. So she'll go in once a month. She's allotted, you know, a time to go there. And, you know, you get a lot of cereal, flour, spaghetti sauce, things like that.
And who's supplying the food to the food pantry?
So that's coming from a food bank, which is a mix of, you know, a food bank getting corporate donations or working with something like Feeding America and getting stuff from there, as well as, you know, sort of local folks donating cans.
We're talking about charity rather than government help.
True, yeah.
You bring up the fact that many people who are food insecure are also overweight. We mentioned that earlier. How is that so often the case? If somebody is not eating, do they wind up becoming fat?
Right. Well, this is the difference between American hunger and sort of developing world hunger. In the U.S., the cheapest calories, or the easiest, I don't want to say cheapest because it's not always just about money, but the easiest, most ubiquitous, most accessible food is usually you know, starchy, sugary, salty. That's the stuff that will stay shelf stable at a food bank and things like that. And particularly if families don't have a lot of cooking knowledge, right, you sort of tend towards that food as well.
A woman from the Poverty and Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress told you that obesity and hunger are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. So
you could be overweight and malnourished at the same time.
Absolutely. You know, if you're eating pretty much just mac and cheese and spaghetti, you're going to not be getting the kinds of nutrients that you need.
We have been hearing that poverty is going up in the suburbs. We always thought of the suburbs as the place that where the middle class lived. What's happening?
Right. So poverty has doubled in the suburbs since, I think it was between 2007 and 2012. So that's obviously a Great Recession issue. It's gotten so intense that some legislators, including Republicans who are sympathetic to the plight of their constituents, have coined the term SUV poor, because what happens is you have families that had a middle class lifestyle, have a house, have a car, have all these things that their kids are doing, and then they lose their job and the bottom falls out from under it. And to try and keep their home and their car and figure out how to sort of get by because they feel like it's a temporary fix, they find that they're having a very hard time keeping their pantry full and staying fed.
And then they are often judged. You have a TV set, you have a fancy car, you have nice clothing. What are you complaining about?
Yeah, that happens a lot. I mean, I've been a little bit shocked at the vitriolic comments that we've been getting on the piece online. Actually, there's been a lot of very judgmental stuff. And you also saw there was this piece in the Washington Post a couple weeks ago about a woman who was a former TV producer, right, who had been on food stamps and went to pick them up and the way that she was judged. And so you see a lot of that coming through.
And later in the show, we'll be talking about why you get that kind of vitriol on the Internet. Part of it is that it's also often anonymous, isn't it? So people can say the things that they might feel uncomfortable saying if they're just talking to someone like me on the air.
Right. It's much easier to say something nasty if there's no eye contact.
We've been hearing that poverty is going up in the suburbs. Is it hard to spot?
It doesn't look the same way as, you know, we think about poverty as being, you know, the iconic sort of gaunt man on the street corner. And, you know, in the suburbs, what you'll have is folks who are just wearing the same nice clothes again and again, or folks who are wearing, you know, stuff they got at thrift stores.
Are there food pantries and other community programs in the suburbs as well?
Yeah. So that is actually a bit of a growth industry now. And it's interesting because, you know, cities have a fairly decent infrastructure in place for delivering emergency food. And in the suburbs, nonprofits are really struggling to sort of get that infrastructure in place and figure out how do you distribute food effectively, particularly in a place like the suburbs where people are really spread out. So how do you locate that? How do you get the food in? How do you get it out? How do you handle that?
And then there are people who feel embarrassed to take advantage of those programs.
Yeah, I think, and particularly in the suburbs, you know, people get pushed pretty far before they're going to sort of go and stand in line at a food pantry and get their groceries that way.
My guest is Tracy McMillan, who's the author of the bestseller, The American Way of Eating. Now an article in the August issue of National Geographic is part of a series the National Geographic is running called The Future of Food, How to Feed Our Growing Planet. Tracy's article is The New Face of Hunger in America. And we will take a little break and be back with more right after this. We are back with Tracy McMillan, whose article, The New Face of Hunger in America, is in the August issue of National Geographic, part of an 8-month series called The Future of Food, How to Feed Our Growing Planet. We mentioned food deserts. How big a problem are they?
So food deserts, last I checked, were affecting about 14 or 15 million Americans. And those numbers might be a little outdated. I think that's from when I was reporting my book. So it's not, you know, an expansive problem, but certainly a big problem in the places where it's an issue.
And what qualifies for a food desert other than the fact that there isn't a supermarket nearby?
That's pretty much the one definition, right? If you don't have a supermarket, I think the way the USDA does it is within a mile of your home. Then that's considered a food desert.
Is it just a supermarket? If you have a butcher shop or a fish shop, does that change things a little bit?
It doesn't in terms of that particular metric, because it's important to remember, right, the food desert metric is, it's kind of a shorthand, right? We use supermarkets because that's a place that will have all of the healthy food that you need to eat. But it doesn't really control for green markets and farmers markets and all the other things.
The Bronx has the highest rate of food insecurity in the country. Really, in the country?
In the
bigger
country?
Than Detroit?
Well, you know, Detroit does not have as big of a food desert problem as most people make it out to. It actually, even this whole time, it's had 85 or 90 local independent supermarkets. And in the last couple of years, it's gotten a couple of full-service grocery stores, including a Whole Foods. So Detroit, for its population, does all right. I don't actually know. I don't know if...
Well, I've heard that the Bronx has more fast food restaurants than grocery stores.
That I would believe, but I would also say that that's probably true for many communities because most communities will have one grocery store, but a McDonald's and a Popeyes and whatever else. So you got to keep in mind, right, that grocery stores and bodegas, there's always more of those than a supermarket.
Are places that are food deserts similar throughout the country?
So they'll vary in terms of income. Like there are sometimes, you know, very affluent communities that don't have a whole lot of grocery stores. It's more common, though,
because it's assumed that you'll get in your car and drive to
some. Right, you can get in your car and drive there. It's not the same problem for a wealthy family as it is for a low-income family. They do concentrate more in low-income neighborhoods, but you will also find them in rural areas as well as urban. And I think in rural, you use like a 10-mile radius as opposed to a 1 mile to measure.
You went to Northwest Houston. Why is it one of the best places in the country to see how people live on what you call a minimum wage diet?
Yeah, so Northwest Houston has one of the highest rates of working SNAP recipients, so folks who are getting food stamps and are working. As I point out in the article, actually, and when you're looking at
what kinds of jobs?
So the thing that I saw most frequently was folks working as home health aides. This is a very common job for women coming off of welfare. So there was a family we spent time with there, the Jeffersons, where the mom, Kai, she worked as a home health aide. Another woman I spent time with, Jacqueline Christian, she was a home health aide as well. It's very common and very low paid. I mean, these women are usually making $7 to $8 an hour.
But all of these, the adults in the Jefferson household work full time. They still can't afford to feed anyone?
So that was an extended family of about 15 or 16 in one house. So they had a four-bedroom house in the suburbs. And it's very interesting, right? So you go to this very leafy suburb, and it's very pretty, and the houses look all right. But if you look closely, they're not necessarily super well-kept. Inside the Jefferson house, it was a fairly run down, and they had, I believe it was four different sort of nuclear families all under one roof, and then you had the three adults trying to make ends meet.
And as I mentioned earlier, if you have television sets, and they do, if you have air conditioning, people say that they must not really be all that poor.
You do hear that a lot. Whenever I hear that, I sort of think, well, you know, it would cost me a lot of money to increase my grocery spending by 20 or 30% or whatever it would cost, right, to cover it. It doesn't cost me a whole lot to get a TV, a couple hundred dollars, and then you have entertainment, which you can't really – it's not like you can take your five kids and go to the movies.
It is interesting that we want people who are poor to suffer, not to live in hot houses and not have a television set so that they can be entertained.
Yeah, it's always an interesting game to play of, you know, well, what is enough suffering that then they're allowed to have the food stamps and things like that.
You mentioned Jacqueline in Houston. She doesn't appear to be poor.
No, well, Jacqueline was a very thrifty shopper. You know, she was making $7-$8 an hour. She's living in a transitional homeless shelter, but she worked as a home health aide. So she needed a car in order to keep her job. So she had a decent car because she needed something reliable. It wasn't fancy. I think it was maybe a Taurus or something used. But, you know, she would go to thrift stores or to discount stores, you know, like we have Rainbow and De Janeiro and things like that here in New York, and go and get clothes like that. If her son, her teenage son, went and worked, she let him keep the money and spend it on what he wanted to. So he had, you know, a nice pair of sneakers. So if you just met her on the street, you wouldn't look at her and think, oh, clearly you are poor and can't figure out where your next meal is coming from. But if you sit down and talk to her, you know, she was really struggling.
Was she relying on fast food, as so many poor people do?
Yeah, so Jacqueline would rely on fast food and sort of supermarket pre-made food with some regularity because she was more or less living out of her car for most of the day, right? So she would drop her sons off at school, then she'd be driving from appointment to appointment to appointment to some school thing for the boys and all that. And so she didn't have any way to really cook, and particularly because she was living in a shelter, she didn't have a kitchen.
Well, that kind of food can be rather unhealthy. So does it cause health problems for people like Jacqueline?
So Jacqueline's health was pretty okay from what I remember, but certainly if somebody is relying on that multiple times a week throughout the year, that's not going to be good for them in the long term.
In Iowa, you met Kiara Reams, who works very hard to feed her family a healthy diet. What does she do?
Yeah, so Kiara was fascinating. She was someone that the photographer Amy Tunsing ran into first, and she... her husband's on disability, he has MS, and they have four kids, and Kiara is obsessed with feeding her kids well. She has a high school diploma and for a variety of reasons wasn't able to go to college. And so, you know, she does the math. I have four children. I have a disabled husband. If I get a job, he can't stay at home and I have to pay to take care of the kids, which isn't going to work. And so she goes foraging. She convinced the local library to get in a bunch of textbooks about how to go and forage for plants. She found somebody that knew how to forage for mushrooms and show her how to do that. She barters. She makes soap in her basement and barters at the farmer's market for beef and things like that. And she certainly makes use of the food bank in town, but she supplements that with an awful lot of produce. She also figured out that you can use SNAP to buy vegetable plants. And so she plants two gardens and eats that through the year.
Where does the food offered in food banks come from? You said you mentioned that they're often paid for by through charitable organizations, but where are they getting the food from?
Right, so it's often overstocked from supermarkets, and there is some degree of I don't know that it's quite the same as like commodity cheese, but it's something where there's a government pipeline of, you know, sort of food that they can buy cheaply and have, but it's always, you know, going to be canned and processed stuff that can sit on the shelves for a long time.
Although in New York, sometimes some of the better restaurants actually donate the food that they don't wind up serving to their customers.
Yeah. Well, New York, and I think it's City Harvest, right, handles all that stuff. I mean, New York has one of the most sophisticated emergency feeding systems.
So it's better to be hungry in New York than other places?
If you're going to be a hungry person, New York would probably be the best. And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at the numbers in the early 1980s, New York had 3 or 4 emergency food programs. Now we have about 1,300.
Have the number of food pantries and soup kitchens grown nationally?
Yeah, they have. There aren't solid numbers for that over time. So usually when people are trying to chart that, they do it in New York. But it's gone from, you know, like emergency food used to be just for total emergencies for folks. And now it's just becoming part of how people get by.
My guest is Tracy McMillan. Her article, The New Face of Hunger in America, is in the August issue of National Geographic, part of an 8-month series called The Future of Food, How to Feed Our Growing Planet. It's also available online at nationalgeographic.com/food. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that it's ironic that people get hungry in rural Iowa despite the fact that they're surrounded by growing food. Why is it that certain foods have gotten cheaper while fresh fruits and vegetables have gotten so much more expensive?
Right. So there's no silver bullet on this, but one thing we do run through in the National Geographic article is that our food supply right now, we're spending a lot of money to subsidize commodity crop production, particularly corn. Very little of the corn actually even ends up as food, right? Most of it becomes fuel or feed for cattle. But
sweet corn, I just read recently, it's very rare that sweet corn has GMO. It's usually regular corn.
Mm-hmm.
But the GMO corn is, as you say, winds up in fuel or in feed or making syrups and things like that.
Right. And so even when you're looking at the stuff that goes into syrups, that's a fairly small amount of the corn that we're producing. But what's happened, right, is we have all this corn sweetener and filler and all that stuff. And corn syrup is great if you're making something shelf stable. And so we've made a lot of this very processed sugary food very cheap and ubiquitous, which I think is really important. We tend to overlook how the ubiquity of this stuff matters. And in the meantime, we're really not spending very much money on subsidizing fruits and vegetables.
So you suggested earlier that the cheapest food is the least nutritious food, mostly.
Cheapest sometimes, right? Because I think you can sort of sit down at any point in time and say, well, it would be cheaper to buy this vegetable than to buy this bag of chips or that, depending on how you want to gauge it. But certainly the most accessible, the easiest to eat, the easiest to get, that's definitely the least healthy food.
And we are doing all sorts of taxpayer-paid subsidies for crops like corn and soy, at the crops that we often don't wind up eating ourselves.
Right, which is really interesting, right, if you look at sort of how we're spending our agricultural subsidies. So we spent about $11.6 billion, I think it was, on commodity crop subsidies in 2012 and about $1.6 billion on specialty crop, which is fruits and vegetables. Meanwhile, so we're looking at, what is that? That's almost like an 8-to-1 ratio, something along those lines. If you look at what we're supposed to be eating at the MyPlate, we're supposed to be eating half fruits and vegetables and then, you know, a quarter grain. So our nutrition guidelines really aren't lining up with where we're putting our agricultural priorities.
And we're doing that partly because in the past we were worried about whether there was going to be enough fuel in this country. So we're subsidizing corn as a way of making fuel. And now we're told that there is a fuel glut. So why do we continue subsidizing it?
Well, there's, you know, a lot of entrenched interest in keeping the subsidies program the way it is. And I think something I was just reading about that really hit home for me was understanding subsidies started, you know, in the 30s when about 40% of Americans lived in rural areas. So those subsidies initially were actually an anti-poverty program for rural America. It's just that now, right, it's going mostly to very large mega farms.
Christina and Kiara, both in Iowa, have planted vegetables. Do SNAP benefits pay for seeds?
They do, actually. And so there's actually a guy in New York that for a while was working on SNAP gardens. So, you know, you can go and spend your food stamps on vegetable plants so that you can eat off your own vegetables.
You focus primarily on women in this article. Does the burden of feeding families and coming up with the money to feed families mainly fall on women?
Food does tend to be a very gendered thing in a household. In low-income households, you know, men often have a lot of financial responsibility. When it comes to cooking and figuring out how to make a meal out of what you're able to afford, that almost exclusively falls to men. So USDA has some really interesting statistics sort of looking at how much time men and women spend cooking. And men across every income group spend a fraction of what women are spending.
Were people open with you on this topic? Did you find that people you spoke with felt shame at this situation?
By the time I got to the families, the photographers usually had met them first. And so I didn't encounter a lot of very open shame. And certainly anyone that's willing to talk to a reporter isn't, you know, shirking away from it. But at the same time, you know, people are really reticent about talking about that feeling. So I would, you know, I spent time with a family that was clearly struggling a lot and didn't even have beds for most of the people in their family. And they just said, oh, well, you know, it's fine. We don't really need beds. We're fine with blankets on the floor.
What about the elderly? Are we seeing more problems with the elderly? And I'm also assuming that if somebody has been self-sufficient throughout his or her life, they're less likely to feel comfortable about suddenly finding themselves struggling to eat.
Right. We did not focus heavily on the elderly in the reporting that we were doing on the ground, but I know from the numbers, right, hunger among the elderly is a bigger problem. And certainly folks from that generation, right, do not want to ask for help. And it's very difficult for folks to sort of say, yeah, I need some help paying for food.
There is still strong resistance to raising the minimum wage and all sorts of arguments about how people will wind up losing their jobs. But even if we raise the minimum wage to, let's say, $10 an hour, do you think that that would even cut down much on the problem you're writing about?
I think that if we had higher wages, you would see a decrease in food insecurity. I mean, something that really struck me was looking at what the minimum wage was in the 1960s, which was about $10.94 an hour, and now it's $7.25 is the federal minimum. So I think that has to have an impact.
We're going to take a quick call here from Claude from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
And Claude, could you make it quick?
Sure. I just wanted to comment how I volunteered at a food bank and I started reading the labels on all the canned stuff, and everything had like 300% sodium. It was just like terrible, terrible food. Even if it was free, I just felt bad, you know, giving these people this food.
I'd imagine that's true around the country.
Yeah. I mean, the donated food is usually canned or it's sugared. So you're just getting food that's, you know, fine for an emergency, but isn't what you should be living off of for all the time.
Claude, thank you so much for calling. And Tracy, thank you so much. Is there anything we've left out?
I think we've done a pretty good job, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
Tracy McMillan's article, a follow-up to the things that you covered in your best-selling book, The American Way of Eating. This is called The New Face of Hunger in America. And it is in the August issue of National Geographic. National Geographic has been doing an 8-month series called The Future of Food, How to Feed Our Growing Planet. And it is available online at nationalgeographic.com/food. Tracy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.